Very good. This is the calendar of the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and welcome counsel to our virtual hearing here. The first matter that we will hear is the case of Jennifer Schroeder versus the Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon. File number is A200272. This matter is before us upon the petition of the proposed intervener, which was denied by the district court. It has been set forth before us for our review of that denial. I understand that the intervener, our proposed intervener, will have 15 minutes for oral argument. There are two respondents, and if you want to note how you intend to split your time on the record, you may do so at this time.
Morning, Your Honor. The Secretary of State will be going first and taking 7 minutes, and then the remaining respondent will be taking 8 minutes second.
All right, very good then. With that understanding, and make sure our marshal understands that division between the two respondents. With that being said, the proposed intervener will have 15 minutes for oral argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. And please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments and identify who you're representing. Thank you very much. And at this time, the proposed intervener may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Cardall. I represent Minnesota Voters Alliance. And as the court mentioned, we're seeking reversal of the denial of the motion. My client's goal here is to ensure that Minnesota courts manage complaints involving claims that Minnesota statutes violate the Minnesota Constitution correctly. And so my first premise, Your Honor, was that we proposed a limited intervention as defendant to assert the affirmative defense of no private cause of action to sue the government for violating the Minnesota Constitution. So it might be helpful, just a matter of background, to ask why did I believe that affirmative defense would be successful? First, Article 3 of the Minnesota Constitution uniquely has an express separation of powers. I've actually been looking at other state constitutions this past week. It's fairly unique. It's sort of special, quirky, but that's who we are. Secondly, the Constitution does not waive sovereign immunity. And then thirdly, the practice in Minnesota since the beginning was that legislative enactments were required to waive sovereign immunity. And what the word for that, or the phrase for that, is private causes of action. And of course, then there are the list of cases, the string cites, showing the affirmative defense has been previously successful. So my goal when I moved to intervene, Your Honor, why I limited the intervention was I didn't want to get into a big discussion of what the intervention rules would be, because the intervention rules, if there's a private cause of action to sue the government for any violation of the Minnesota Constitution, if you can imagine the due process clause, you could sue townships, school districts, drainage authorities, watershed districts, counties, state agencies for violating the Minnesota Constitution. So our goal is now.
Thankfully, Mr. Cardale, would you repeat what you just said, because you cut out for a moment?
Our goal was not to broaden the intervention rule, Rule 24.01, but rather to follow Engelrup, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision, and the federal treaties, as I mentioned, that I quote from, and the U.S. Supreme Court case in Missouri, Kansas Pipeline Company, that basically in certain circumstances, if there's a sound reason to grant intervention, the court does it. Now, I view that as part of the interest. I know the respondents disagree. Maybe you could say it's another reason to grant intervention, but certainly required, and the court should not.
But there's no Minnesota case that adopts that reasoning, am I correct? In other words, you're relying on federal law, federal case law, and for that theory, am I correct?
Yeah, I think that's right, that I'm asking for the Court of Appeals to recognize if there's a sound reason to grant intervention for the purpose of Minnesota courts managing complaints involving claims that Minnesota statutes violate the Minnesota Constitution correctly. So we're all concerned about these complaints involving legislative enactments where there are claims that they violate the Minnesota Constitution, that the courts handle them correctly.
So Mr. Caudill, but I'm trying to focus less on kind of what are the merits of the defense and more on Rule 24. And looking at that, I just want to be really clear about what your client's interest is in the subject of this action. If I thought reading your briefs, you were saying it is in preventing unnecessary litigation costs. And now I hear you saying, well, it's also about this public interest. So tell me, which is it? Because to me, that's the starting place for analyzing Rule 24.
The starting point of analyzing Rule 24 is, in this case, is how are we going to ensure that the Minnesota courts get to the right conclusion? We're concerned about getting it correct. And so the interest issue, as I mentioned, that our interest in the first, and I pled that we said, if we're correct, as the previous cases state, that the affirmative defense means this kind of lawsuit is not allowed in Minnesota ever, then it's a waste of taxpayer funds and resources. And so we would want in every one of these cases, because that's the law of the land.
But Mr. Caudill, that would seem to me to be, then you're saying that anytime you think the Attorney General's office is not adequate, is not doing the best job possible defending the state, that you have a right, not just an actual right to intervene. And from my perspective, that's a long stretch of the law. I mean, and this is my fundamental concern with your position. So let me just give you a chance to respond. Is it appears to me, if you think the Attorney General's office isn't doing its job, then there's one, you know, the rules of professional conduct. If they're violating them, you take it to the court. If not, you know, these are matters for elections, and elections matter. And maybe you want to run against the Attorney General, but that's very different than intervening in every case where you think the office isn't doing its job.
Okay, if Judge, again, our point of departure is, do we care about the courts handling these correctly? And so the first part is, there's a practice in Minnesota based on Article 3 of the Minnesota Constitution, which is an express separation of powers. The Constitution does not waive sovereign immunity. The practice has been that the appellate courts respect that and know that the legislative enactments authorize the private causes of action which waive sovereign immunity. And the cases show, based on those principles, that this defense has always been successful. So what's being proposed here by the court is a new way of governing ourselves, where, as opposed to the legislature deciding when and where we can sue, the Attorney General gets to make this defense or not. And what that introduces into the court system is bias. So my understanding of the court is that we're supposed to not have bias, not have implied bias. And here, you know, a liberal plaintiff can sue and a conservative plaintiff can't. And that's exactly the type of bias we can't allow in our system, or everything's going to become bipolarized. There'll be two sides. You know, it's up to the Attorney General to decide who can sue and who can't. And I've been trying to do is very carefully protect the court's reputation and not have that bipolarization. We've had a lot of success in not bipolarizing things. We've had success in fighting bias, implied bias, and here we're allowing bias. And that's not good. That's not correct. And what we need to do is ensure that the plaintiffs of every stripe, left, right, up, and down, are allowed the same access to the court. And for the Court of Appeals to say, oh, okay, you know, the Attorney General can file this affirmative defense here, but not here, that's bias.
Well, could I ask you this? Because in preparation for today, I read the case of Cruz Guzman versus State, and there's a big discussion there by the majority in that opinion about there is a right to challenge constitutional violations, and that's a right that can be brought by that this is a right that's recognized under our system of justice. And if I know that case was cited by at least one of the respondents here, how do you explain then your and as I understand what you're arguing, you're saying that there should be no private right of action and no way of challenging this. How do you square that up with Cruz Guzman?
That was another case the Attorney General didn't assert the affirmative defense. So if the affirmative defense isn't adjudicated, then that's not binding on this Court of Appeals. The issue here is when the affirmative defense has to be pled, and as the Attorney General's office knows, time and time and time again, it successfully pled that and won. So yeah, there
Well, in this case, they're not asking for damages. Am I correct? They're asking for a declaration that the statute is unconstitutional. Am I correct on what's being requested?
That's my understanding.
All right, and so the you're only asking for the limited intervention to bring an affirmative defense that I'm trying to understand how you would have a right to that affirmative defense in light of the Cruz Guzman case. How do you get there? And I guess I'd like you to explain that to me.
I thought I did. Maybe I did a poor job of explaining that in the Cruz Guzman case, the affirmative cause of action that wasn't raised, so it wasn't adjudicated. So if it's not adjudicated, then it's not binding on this court.
Well, justiciability was adjudicated, and they were bringing the issue of justiciability based on separation of powers doctrine that you've raised here. And they did indicate that that's part of jurisdiction in the Cruz Guzman. So why is this case different?
I don't read the case that way. This is different because the private affirmative defense is clearly in our proposed answer presented, and the court can adjudicate it. All my client's concerned about is that the Minnesota appellate courts have a rule that applies to all plaintiffs. And so if the Attorney General's office is just going to file this affirmative defense against my plaintiffs and in federal court and state court, we're going to lose, then the Attorney General says, oh, we're not going to file this affirmative defense here. That doesn't sit with the...
is your understanding of the affirmative defense that you claim that the Attorney General raises? Because one of the points made again by the plaintiff respondents is that the cases you cite all involve cases involving damages. They did not involve a declaration of constitutional rights, which is what's involved here. How do you respond to that distinction in the cases you cited in your favor?
Well, the cases did involve seeking declaratory relief. With respect to the Supreme Court decisions they're relying on, the affirmative defense wasn't raised. Further, the way that it works under the Constitution heretofore, as Article 3 is an express separation of powers, no one in one branch can do what the other branch is supposed to do. So no judge can waive sovereign immunity. So that's one of the things here. And the Constitution leaves to the legislature waiving sovereign immunity. So here the Court of Appeals is saying, we can waive sovereign immunity for declaratory judgment actions. Certainly the declaratory judgment action, I have a bunch of cases, the Declaratory Judgment Act doesn't authorize a private action to sue the government in every situation. Now, the Constitution is quite useful.
Can I ask you this? Is this a matter? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but is this a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, or is it a matter of justiciability? Are we talking about the same thing?
I think it's a, I mean, sorry, Your Honor, to me, it's just a matter of the courts handling these correctly, and it's probably relates to subject matter jurisdiction. So the point is that under the Minnesota Constitution, all these cases are being decided, some of the Attorney General's office is involved in, saying there's no private cause of action in the Minnesota courts to sue in this way. Now, there are plenty of legislative enactments authorizing lawsuits that the courts are aware of. The Minnesota Tort Claims Act, there's the Data Practices Act, there's all sorts of different rights to sue the government. So if the court were to say, all right, you can bring a declaratory judgment action whenever you think any government entity is violating the law, it's a big change. And so I welcome that debate. If that's what the court wants, is to have people be able to sue the government in anticipation of being ticketed. Because I advise people every day that, hey, you got to wait to charge or sued before you can invoke your Minnesota constitutional rights.
So, Mr. Cardall, if I may.
Go ahead.
I mean, in your briefing, you acknowledge that your interest doesn't fit into the precise bounds of Rule 24, right?
No.
And so I'm just, with that in mind, could you address the Heller case? Because while not precedential and it was a slightly different matter, that seemed to me to be saying, look, where someone wanted to intervene because they were critical of attorney's fees, they thought this would add to their costs of ice cream, I think it was, that wasn't a sufficient interest. And shouldn't that case, especially where you acknowledge we're not in the precise parameters of Rule 24 and we're in court, counsel is to say there's not a right to intervene?
I don't know if I was heard before, but we argued in our briefs, Your Honor, that we did meet the requirements of Rule 24, and that with respect to interests, we detailed our view of interest would include the sort of thing that we were talking about, that a person, let's see, safeguarding a party's interests cannot be left to only public officials and the court's discretion. And so what I kind of sense is the court is kind of resisting the idea that my client has an interest in the public legislation that's in place not being undone by a Ramsey County District Court, a plaintiff, an attorney general's office, who the court said is politically elected. So, wants to go this other direction that, we should certainly have I think the notice should go out to the government attorneys who represent and are paid by insurance companies, the townships, the school districts, the counties, the state agencies. Because what the Attorney General's office is proposing is that everyone can sue everybody, and it's just a brand new way of doing things. I made a living suing the government. Of course I have an interest in this. And so if the court's going to say everyone can sue everyone for declaratory judgments, injunctions, it's a whole new world for plaintiff's attorneys. And I think that's great, but that decision should be made by a court, not by the Attorney General office turning on and off the faucet regarding the affirmative defense. Thank you.
All right, the respondent may proceed at this time.
Excuse me. Good morning, my name is Alan Barr. I represent respondent Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon. For a party to be entitled to intervention as of right, that party must have an interest in the subject matter of the case. MVA concedes as much that it does not have such an interest when it says that it is not perhaps within the bounds of Rule 24.01 governing intervention as of right.
Could I ask you the same question I asked counsel? Is justiciability and subject matter jurisdiction the same thing, or are we talking about two different concepts?
I believe we're talking about the same concept, Your Honor, but the court doesn't need to reach any of those issues because this appeal is fundamentally not about whether or not the private cause of action exists. Rather, this appeal is about whether or not appellants satisfy the criteria for intervention as of right.
Why doesn't the court need to reach that issue here? I guess that's because basically, as I understand, and Mr. Cardale can correct me, as I understand his arguments is that he attached to his briefing at during this litigation a number of briefs by the Attorney General where you argued on behalf of the people and the government that there is no private cause of action, and those cases are cited, and they actually cite from your brief. And basically, as I understand Mr. Cardale's argument, he doesn't think that the Attorney General should be able to pick and choose which cases have subject matter jurisdiction, if I understand his argument. How do you respond to that? And can we just dance around that issue and not deal with it here?
Well, first, Your Honor, with respect to the Attorney General picking, to be clear, the Attorney General is a party in this case. We're representing the Secretary of State. But as to dancing around it, it's not a favoritism for one party or another. There are reasons why our office, in consultation with our clients, chooses to raise defenses in some cases and not others. As you pointed out, there are strategic considerations such as whether there are damages being pursued. The tactics chosen in this particular case, I'm not going to go into, that would fall under the work product doctrine, but to say that we are picking and choosing plaintiffs that can succeed simply isn't the case. Moreover,
is it a matter of trial strategy, or is it a matter of law in how you proceed? In other words, is there a private cause of action for damages in all cases, if you're bringing a constitutional violation claim?
Your Honor, it's a matter of trial strategy to choose in a particular case whether or not that will be the best defense. As I point out in my brief, that just because every possible defense could be raised, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's adequate representation is inadequate if a party does not raise every possible defense. Rather, you want to raise defenses that, because you're concerned that other defenses are going to get lost in the weeds. Moreover, regardless of whether or not this defense exists, and regardless of whether or not it would be successful here, I would encourage the court to focus on whether or not MVA has an interest in the subject matter of this case. In his argument, Mr. Cardell identified an interest in getting cases correct, but certainly every Minnesota citizen shares that same interest. We want to get cases decided correctly.
Can I ask you this? If the argument is there's an affirmative defense of subject matter jurisdiction, lack of subject matter jurisdiction, and that's the affirmative defense, how does the district court even get to decide this issue of intervention if there's no subject matter jurisdiction? Do you understand my question? Because how do we analyze this case is what I'm asking.
Sure. So the court
judge doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction, how does the judge even address the intervention claim?
Well, so it's subject matter intervention as between the claims between the plaintiff, Ms. Schroeder et al., and the Secretary of State. So the intervention piece is a whole separate piece of the case. The judge doesn't need to look at whether or not there is subject matter jurisdiction to determine whether or not someone can intervene in a case to raise defenses.
Go ahead.
If I should just move quickly to a different subject. I mean, while Mr. Cardale talked mostly about, getting it right, I'm trying to paraphrase him, and those issues in their briefs, they also say that his client has a public interest in the voting statutes and has a long history. And I think this is in the notice of promoting election integrity. Sorry. Why isn't that an appropriate interest in the subject of the litigation? I mean, just their background, that's at the purpose of the organization he represents. And if that's the case, aren't we really then talking about the fourth element, you know, is that interest adequately represented by your client?
So you have to be careful, Your Honor, in that I think part of what appellants are trying to do is conflate the fourth and second prongs of the test for intervention. There are separate questions of whether or not there's an interest in the subject matter versus whether or not that interest is adequately represented. So it seems to me that appellants are trying to say that if the Secretary of State does a bad enough job trying to defend the statute, somehow that gives rise to an interest in the subject matter, when really those are separate questions.
I understand that. And I'm just saying, if the values of the organization give them a sufficient interest in the subject of the of the action, then don't we necessarily get to the fourth prong? And if we get to the fourth prong, that's supposed to be a minimal burden to show. And isn't the fact that your office didn't make this defense, isn't that enough to meet that minimal showing?
So 2 points on that, Your Honor. First, with respect to having an interest in the subject matter, merely being concerned about election integrity is not enough. This court in Kotsky v. Chicago Northwestern Transportation went through and listed what sort of interests constitute an interest in the subject matter of a case, that you will suffer damages, that you will be compelled to do something if a judgment is issued, if you will be prohibited from doing something. MVA's right will not be affected in any of those ways. So merely election integrity isn't enough. And as to adequacy of representation, I would disagree that it's a minimal burden. Looking at the federal rule governing intervention as a right, which the Minnesota Supreme Court and this court have routinely looked to, federal courts have held that under the federal rule, if there's a state agency defending the constitutionality of a statute, then there's a presumption of adequacy unless there's a showing of bad faith.
That federal rule, I think you're talking about the Eighth Circuit case, that's relatively recent. That hasn't been adopted by our court or the Minnesota Supreme Court. And so wouldn't that be an additional step we'd have to take? If we just talk about precedent, aren't we talking about a minimal showing?
If we're limiting it to Minnesota cases, that you would have to, the showing is, it, the test is minimal under Minnesota case law. That said, I don't believe there's been any such showing here.
All right. Well, thank you. I think your time has ended and you actually had a moment or two over. But I wanted you to answer Judge Jessen's question. So the respondent plaintiffs may proceed at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court, Michael Sawyer is here today on behalf of the plaintiff respondents. The narrow issue before the court is whether appellant has met this court and the Minnesota standing and iterations of Rule 2401 intervention as of right. The answer is an emphatic no, they don't. And in fact, the appellant concedes on page 4 of its principal brief that it doesn't fit within the bounds. And as this court knows, it's not the prerogative of the Minnesota Court of Appeals to recognize new and novel methods or modes of intervention. That should really end the inquiry and we could be done. But
without a determination of whether the judge in fact had subject matter jurisdiction in this matter?
Your Honor, that's an excellent question. The answer is that this is a subject matter justiciability issue. Is there a claim over which the court is allowed to exercise authority? And the answer is that there is a claim. The court is allowed to exercise authority, and we don't have to look any further than Cruz Guzman just 2 years ago, where the Minnesota Supreme Court issued a decision weighing whether there was a deprivation of constitutional rights under the Minnesota Constitution. If the Minnesota Supreme Court in Cruz Guzman, in Kahn, Doe v. Gomez, in Skeen v. State, all cases that are cited in our briefing, can make the decision of whether there's a violation of Minnesota constitutional rights, then this court should take that lead and accept either A, accept the fact that there is a private cause of action, or B, not address it because the Minnesota Supreme Court, if Mr. Cardall is right, didn't go through that analysis. And so ultimately, 2018 in Cruz Guzman, the court made its decision and said over and over that it is the primary purpose of the Minnesota courts to the constitutionality of the state's actions. And that's not a new or a novel concept. We can go back 220 years, as the Cruz Guzman court did, to Marbury versus Madison. It is antithetical and repugnant to our democracy that the state can deprive someone of constitutional rights and there's no judicial recourse. And so Cruz Guzman went back and cited Marbury versus Madison. But again, in 93, in Skeen versus State, in 95, Doe versus Gomez, this is not a new concept that Minnesota citizens are entitled to come to this court or come to the district court and say the state of Minnesota has deprived me of my constitutional rights and declare it. We're not talking about damages. I think most if not all of the cases that appellant relies on are federal court cases that implicate sovereign immunity. They involve claims of damages. But I think even more importantly, let's look at where all those cases are getting their authority. They all track back to Geit versus Wright, and it's a 1997 case out of the District of Minnesota, Federal District Court. And it's really important that the court look at this because this seems to be the genesis of the misstatement of law that there is no, the broad misstatement of law that there's no private cause of action. In Geit, this is directly from the case. Although the complaint states claims under the Minnesota Constitution, plaintiff admitted during the hearing on this motion that there is no private cause of action for violations of the Minnesota Constitution. The court dismisses those claims. So while Mr. Cardall says, well, it's not adjudicated, this isn't presented to the courts in Cruz Guzman, so we shouldn't rely on the two-year-old Minnesota Supreme Court case, it wasn't adjudicated in Geit. And then Eggenberger, the other case cited routinely, relies heavily on Geit as well.
Well, isn't subject matter jurisdiction too an issue that can be raised even by the court or even by this court?
Absolutely,
it's always. It can't be waived.
Absolutely, so. And it's not that this court can; it's that every court is obligated to ensure that it has subject matter jurisdiction. And so, because in this case we have such recent precedent in which the Minnesota Supreme Court said we're going to weigh these constitutional claims, we're going to weigh whether the school district is engaged in segregationist policy under the Minnesota Constitution. We can accept that, or the court can analyze and adopt what Cruz Guzman said 2 years ago. But ultimately, I think it's a distinction without difference, because we know that if there's no cause of action, that means the court's without authority to act. So really, there's no jurisdiction. So I think it is jurisdictional. It's a justiciability question. And I think we've got that answer from pretty recent precedent.
Mr. Sawyer,
well,
this
is there. Go ahead.
This is Judge Flory. I just have a real quick procedural question. Briefing indicates that the parties as they exist now have briefed their summary judgment motions. I think this goes to perhaps the mootness argument. What's the status in district court? Has there been a hearing on those summary judgment motions? Does the district court judge have that under advisement at this time?
It's a great question, Your Honor. Yes, the district court has the matter under advisement. A decision is due any day now.
So my thought is that judge has 90 days to decide what he already had under advisement. This court will have 90 days from today to make a decision. It seems that if the judge would grant the state's motion for summary judgment, the case would be this issue would become moot.
Absolutely, Your Honor, it would be moot, and I would submit to the court that it's moot already. This appeal is moot because the interest expressed at the district court was the preservation of their funds. At this point, appellant is working against its interest. For if that premise is to be accepted, that by being present in this litigation, the Attorney General and the Secretary of State are expending taxpayer funds, Mr. Cardall and his client are working against that interest, forcing the state to be here today, forcing the state to litigate an issue that's already under advisement. So on some level, it is no longer timely, and it would frankly work serious prejudice if the appellant were allowed to intervene at the district court, because again, as the court, to answer the court's earlier question, we are less than 3 weeks away from the 90-day deadline. Now, we haven't heard whether the district court will ask for an extension. We'll seek the party's consent to an extension. But if not, we'll have a decision any day. And if it's not already moot, the appeal will become moot once that decision is issued. So I would submit whether it's a mootness issue that deprives this court of subject matter jurisdiction, or it's a failure of that first element. If it's a failure of that first element, whether it's a timely request. Now recall, appellant didn't seek a stay in the district court, didn't seek mandamus from this court, didn't seek any expedited relief from this court. And so that renders this an untimely request for intervention, and would, again, either render it moot, robbing this court of jurisdiction, or cause a failure of that first element, requiring this court to affirm the district court.
I don't see my timer anymore.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
If I may, but there's an exception to the mootness doctrine for situations that are likely to reoccur. And just, you know, listening to counsel for appellants, Mr. Cardle's arguments, I mean, that seems, wouldn't that be very relevant to our decision here?
It may be relevant, Your Honor, but I think it's a discretionary exception. It's not something, you know, the court can decide that it comes up so infrequently. When it comes to declarations, now damages is a separate question. We're not here to talk about damages, but when it comes to declarations only, that type of relief is so infrequent that the court could, in its discretion, say, we're still going to find it moot. And if Mr. Cardall wants to bring a lawsuit, and his clients want to bring a lawsuit asserting the deprivation of constitutional rights one way or another, they certainly are entitled to do that and test their pet theory in that forum. And again, I apologize, I don't see my timer. I just a word on interest before I close, if I may. There's been a shift in interest expressed by the appellants several times. We heard at the district court, it was the preservation of taxpayer funds. We heard in its brief at page 28 that it's an interest in voting laws generally. We've heard today that it's a public interest in essentially, as far as I can tell, checking the courts, being an independent check on this constitutional body's right to declare laws constitutional or unconstitutional. And I don't know anywhere that individual citizens are entitled to be a check on the proper function of the courts, on the courts, quote, I think Mr. Cardall said, getting it right. That's certainly not the law. And it certainly would lead to a rule without limiting principle. Plaintiffs could come in for any purpose. And I think if the district court, Mr. Cardall said, an attorney can come in to any court and express an interest and intervene no matter the subject under advisement before the court. So I think it's a difficult rule. I'll close if unless the court has questions. Appellant asks this court to endorse an unprecedented and intolerable principle that the state of Minnesota may arbitrarily deprive citizens of constitutional rights, leaving its citizens without remedy. Not only is that antithetical to the primary and proper function of the courts, it reeks of an authoritarian doctrine with no place in Minnesota or any other functioning democracy, and plaintiff respondents respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's order denying intervention. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Cardale.
I'm going to try to do my best to address a couple of your Honor's questions. So with Judge Flory's question, you know, there's the one hand, the defendant wins, and yeah, I think it becomes moot unless, of course, the plaintiff appeals. But on the other hand, if the plaintiff wins, the Attorney General's office has waived this argument. So how does it properly get presented to the Court of Appeals, the subject matter jurisdiction question? And I think
if it's a subject matter jurisdiction, right, though, isn't it non-waivable? I mean, that's something the court can raise on its own volition at any time, correct?
Oh, but then we're running into that problem, Judge. And we have to be careful with the courts being not only being impartial, but also appearing impartial. So the
court. No, I'm just talking about what the law is, though, regarding subject matter jurisdiction. Isn't that the law?
The Court of Appeals and the district courts can raise that, but is the court, but that's by the court's discretion, right? The court has to make a decision. So whether a liberal group can sue or a conservative group can sue, if the Attorney General's office doesn't raise the defense,
Well, are you, because I want to make sure that we understand your argument, and counsel for the plaintiff respondent here just argued that you're basically saying that no one can ever bring a private cause of action to contest the violation of the Constitution by the government. Am I correct? Is that your argument, or is that what there are? Is that, are they correct? And that's what you're arguing here.
Your Honor, this is what I've said, I think, three or four times now, that in Minnesota, the Minnesota Constitution has not waived sovereignty from lawsuit. There's an explicit separation of powers. And what we've done now for over 100 years is legislature enacts private cause of action to sue the government, and then the state courts follow it. So most famously, we have the Tort Claims Act, we have the Environmental Rights Act. You know, all these people go to the state legislature and say, we need a private cause of action, we need a private cause of action. And they work hard to get it. And here, the Attorney General's office is saying, I can grant them whenever I want to. And that's, you know, it's just not right. It's not fair. It introduces bias in the system. And to leave it to a court to, so in the liberal case, the judge says, well, no subject matter jurisdiction. In the conservative plaintiff case, there is, or vice versa. And so the point is that we're in a position where we can, the Court of Appeals can make these decisions, but it has to be presented to the court. And the plaintiffs and the defendants could have handled this much differently. They could have stipulated the intervention, and then we could have presented this issue to the district court. The district court could have ruled on it, then eventually get to the Court of Appeals. And that's how I'm accustomed to practicing law, when there are important issues about opening and closing the courthouse door. I mean, I have so many plaintiffs who want to do this. But in Minnesota, the Minnesota Constitution, as this court knows, and my friends representing the other parties here are conflating on this point. Minnesota Constitution is a bulwark of liberty. If you're cited, ticketed, charged, or sued by the government, the Court of Appeals, the court, district court, we're ready to hear your arguments. But this is a big step going to, you can sue the government for any violation of the Minnesota Constitution. I don't know what it'll look like, but I do know if that decision is going to be made, all the insurance trust government attorneys should be there. Because those insurance trust government attorneys have no problem raising this defense, and they win cases time after time after time. It's the only Attorney General's office is the only subset of government attorneys who's doing it this way. And so who are we going to go with? The government attorneys who are hired by the insurance trust and the other government attorneys, or the Attorney General's office who wants to turn the faucet on sometimes and turn it off? I believe this is the right vehicle. I've been trying to do this in a grown-up, mature way. Present it to the court so the court can make a decision. And of course, I can live with whatever decision the court makes. But we can't live with the AG's office letting liberal plaintiffs through. And then when conservatives sue, they bring these defenses. So that's bias. And we have to fight bias. We have to fight not only direct bias, but indirect bias. And the idea that somehow I'm against liberty. No, I'm not against liberty. I understand the separation of powers is an important part of defending our liberties. So we know where to go to change the rules. So let's say to city council, if a city council ordinance is unconstitutional and I haven't been ticketed, well, I go to the city council and I say, that's unconstitutional, change it. I don't run to the Hennepin County District Court and say, oh, it's unconstitutional. That's just not how we do it in Minnesota. I said before, I think Minnesota's way we do it is kind of special or quirky, and maybe it's both. And we stick with the way we've been doing it because we've kept peace that way and domestic tranquility. We're in it together, and I don't think we should change things. And I think my client has expressed an interest in this proceeding as described before. Thank you.
So, Mr. Cardall, if I may ask one question. I just want to be clear about what you're asking this court. You're not asking us necessarily to decide this issue about the private cause of action, are you? I mean, I read your papers to say, no, you want us to say you can intervene as of right so you can present that issue below. I just want to be clear what you're asking us to do.
Right. And I, Judge, I submit that I've done a poor job of explaining this. So what I've been trying to argue is that there's an important legal question here that needs to be presented in the district court, and it's not being presented, and eventually should be presented to the Court of Appeals. And if the court believes that you know, there's a good chance there's no private cause of action, I don't see a reason to broaden Rule 24. But if the court is feeling like maybe Judge Hooten's question suggested, that there's this broad private cause of action and everyone can sue every government entity for violating the Minnesota Constitution, then the court really has to seriously relook, take a new look at its intervention rule. Because if every state statute is going to be reviewed constitutionally in the district court, we better have more involvement than just the plaintiff and the attorney general's office, because you're actually engaging in almost a legislative process. And if we're going to replace the legislative process with the court determining all these issues, then we're going to have more interveners. And I don't want to upset the intervention rule. I didn't set out to do that. That's why I said limited intervention, because I think the court sees that there's a value in the intervention rule. But here we need to recognize an interest, or when there's a sound reason to do so. Thank you.
And Mr. Cardale, I just want to make sure, because this was also raised by the plaintiff respondent. Is your interest here limited to the expenditure of taxpayer dollars? Is that your claimed interest in this case? The unnecessary expenditure of taxpayer dollars? I guess I want to understand exactly what interest you are protecting here with your proposed intervention.
Okay, I'm going to try again. I'm not doing a very good job. I need to. There's two separate arguments. So one argument is based on the premise, you know, eventually the court's going to go along with me, and there's no private cause of action. And so in that case, if the court's eventually going to go along with me, we can leave the intervention rule in place and just say, you know, this is an interest, there's inadequate representation by the defendant, we need to make sure this is properly presented, it's a subject matter jurisdiction issue. However, if the court is going to say, oh, Cruz Guzman, all this, there's a private cause of action, then we really do need to look at the intervention rule and broadening the concept of interest.
Do you want to repeat that? You cut out for a few moments.
If all these constitutional issues are resolved in the district court, then we're going to need to broaden the intervention rule to allow more participants, because there's an issue of the legitimacy of the court. So if you end up saying, well, only the plaintiff can participate, no one else can intervene in this constitutional issue, then it doesn't look like all the sides are represented as you determine these constitutional issues. I mean, in this case, we're saying that under the Minnesota Constitution, felons have the right to vote in the Minnesota Constitution forever. And heretofore, it was always assumed that, you know, there's no private cause of action. So, you know, the state legislature decides, or, you know, if someone were ticketed, they could raise this as a defense, right? If someone was cited. And so I think that's where I'm at, is that my preferred course would be, you know, don't reach the merits, but recognize that there's a sound reason to allow the intervention. Let me go back, set up the issue of subject matter jurisdiction, and then the court will have the record. Now, if the case is dismissed otherwise, it's moot. But the problem is, if the plaintiff wins, you know, that issue is not going to appeal.
Mr. Cardale, you're cutting out again. You need to repeat the last few seconds.
All right. So if the district court grants summary judgment to the plaintiffs, the attorney general office won't be raising this affirmative defense for review in the Minnesota Court of Appeals, this court. So, I mean, it seems to me like the way that the Minnesota Supreme Court case, Eglerup, and the U.S. Supreme Court and federal rule guidance is that sometimes there's a sound reason to allow intervention to have the court decide issues correctly, and this seems to be one of those. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you very much. Any other questions from the panel? All right, very good. We will take the matter under advisement, and thank you for